I just saw something that made me laugh. And because I'm recording this right before Yom Kippur, my people's Day of Atonement, I can say it real quickly and then atone for the pettiness. So earlier today, Marjorie Taylor Greene, the ignorant piece of shit congresswoman from Georgia, who has definitely never met a conspiracy theory she doesn't believe, took to Twitter to wish all of us a good Yom Kippur. To all those preparing for the solemn day of Yom Kippur, she wrote, I wish you a meaningful fast. She then attached an image of a shofar alongside a Hanukkah menorah. My name is Jeff Perlman. I'm the New York Times bestselling author of 10 books and the host of Two Writers, Sling and Yang, the podcast where one writer, me, talks writing with another writer every single week. And today's guest is Benjamin Hockman, the outstanding St. Louis Post-Dispatch sports columnist. And in today's episode, we're going to take one of Ben's fantastic recent columns, headline, Adam Wainwright in St. Louis, A Love Story, and break it down piece by piece by piece. And I got to tell you, I love this shit. This is episode number 330. Let's sling some yang.
Dad, your podcast sucks, and you're kind of a loser now without your TV show.
All right, Benjamin, let me ask you a serious question to start. What is your best piece of memorabilia on the wall behind you that seems like an ode to everything St. Louis and Bo Jackson?
Well, actually, if we're doing this, my absolute favorite thing is this Sandy Koufax Life magazine, which is the same photo that they ended up using on that book. But I also have an Ozzie Smith for Mayor sign and, of course, the ABA basketball.
I have a brick from Bo Jackson's childhood home. That's my best thing so far. Okay. You've been a columnist for many moons. You were a columnist at the Denver Post. You're now a columnist in St. Louis. You've been a sports writer for many moons. You got out of Missouri in 2002. And I was thinking of doing something with you that I thought would be really fun and different. And I don't usually do this, which is you had a column that just ran. And for people listening, this will be a week ago. It ran and it was Adam Wainwright and St. Louis, A Love Story. And it was after Adam Wainwright won his 200th game. And I haven't done this in a long time in the show. I thought it'd be really cool if your game to actually break a column down and how you did it and what you went about it and the little intricacies and the details and the word choices and all the nerdy stuff that makes a good column a really good column.
Sure, let's do it, man.
Let's start with this. The column came out September 19th. And Adam Wainwright, you obviously write a lot about the Cardinals. Adam Wainwright is a star with the Cardinals. He's 42. He's in his last season. Basic, lame beginning question. Why did you write this column at this time, at this moment?
So 200 wins is the bar for Adam Wainwright. He's wanted this for many, many years. And then this year has been a terrible year for him. His ERA is like in the sevens. But he is a beloved St. Louis ball player. And, you know, we in St. Louis, we love our ball players. And I know people call St. Louis fans the best fans of baseball in kind of a ridicule sort of way. But, you know, I'm from here originally, and now I'm back as a columnist. And there really is something beautiful about the relationship between the baseball team and the citizens of St. Louis. So here was Wainwright going for this record, getting his 200th win. And I just wanted to pay homage to him. And I knew that Derek Gould, our great beat writer, was going to write the heck out of the main game story. And I needed to come up with an angle, a different angle. And I try to write something that I would want to read and something that would hopefully resonate with the readers. So I was like, what is this about Wainwright? It's a love story. It's St. Louis and Adam Wainwright, and it's a mutual love story. It's not just the fans bowing down to the superstar. It's a superstar adoring and appreciating the town he plays in.
You go to the game that night. Like, if Wainwright gets rocked for 10 runs in two innings, are you still writing a Wainwright piece, or did he have to do well?
A little peek behind the curtain. We have deadlines at 7 o'clock now because newspapers are not like they were when we were growing up. So I literally, for the newspaper the next morning, my column was about St. Louis City SC, the soccer team that's first place in the Western Conference. That day I'd gone to practice, did a whole thing about a great goal they scored in the previous game. So I was good to go for the paper. I went to the game specifically to write about Wainwright, if he got the 200th win or if he got like super close. So to your question, if he had blown it, I would not have written about it. And frankly, I thought he wouldn't get it, if only because they were facing Freddy Peralta, who's pitched his butt off lately. And so I was like, will the Cardinals even score? And they only scored one run off Milwaukee, but it was enough.
How long before the game starts do you get there?
Oh gosh, I got there like two hours before I had to finish the soccer column. So I filed the soccer column like during the national anthem, essentially, right before the national anthem, if you will.
And you all right? So you're not pre-reporting Wainwright. You're not in the Cardinals clubhouse. You're not like asking guys around because you're working on your soccer column.
Well, and moreover, and I thought about this, of course, like I do pre-report a lot in numerous circumstances, but this one, I was like, it's going to be about the accomplishment and what is said after it. I didn't feel like I needed to get, you know, Paul Goldschmidt on if Wainwright gets it tonight, what could happen. I figured I would just cover the scene itself.
Is that an ethical thing to do? Would it have been okay for you to say to Paul Goldschmidt, hey, I'm going to be writing a column if Adam Wainwright pitches well tonight. Can you give me a quote about how good he is or how well he did or what this means to you in anticipation of him doing it?
I think the answer to that is you can't have him talk about something that hasn't happened. Can't be like, oh, Wainwright looks so good in the 200th winner. But you can ask him, like, what makes Wainwright great? What got him to this point in his career, 199 wins, and kind of set it up like that. But you don't want to be disingenuous to your readers.
Okay, so you get there, and the game is going on. And I remember from my baseball covering days that I spent a lot of time not watching games. Like I spent a lot of time, whatever, on social media, sure. When I was in Dodger Stadium, getting my seventh refill of Coke and filling it with ice cream, you know, like walking around, using the bathroom, talking to sure. people. When you're writing about a specific thing, you're here for a specific reason. If Wainwright pitches well and Wainwright is pitching well, what percentage of you is actually hyper-focused on the game while it's going on?
Yeah, I would say that when the Cardinals were in the field, I was hyper-focused. And I watched the whole game, but the pretzels are very delicious in the press box in St. Louis. So I made sure to get one or two of those. And my wife is pregnant, but due to these pretzels, I myself look like my wife right now. You're watching the game, but clearly when Wainwright's holding the baseball, that's what I'm most focused on. And because you're always looking for details, right? What a high percentage of people that are going to read your column have already seen the game. So I'm just looking for little things, little moments, what have you. And I'm taking notes on my screen, just something that can capture the moment or show where Wainwright was mentally, as well as physically.
All right. So for people who may not know, you're sitting in the press box. So you're not like super close to the action. I mean, you have a decent view and you have the TV monitors or whatever, you know, you're watching it. Are you looking for stuff that he does, a tug of the cap, a breathe into his hand? Or are you looking for what fans are doing? Are you looking around you? Like, what kind of details are you actually seeking?
All of the above. I mean, I'm constantly looking for little nuggets that could enhance my column. You know, I used to be an intern at the Sporting News when I was younger, and they had a banner that said, tell me something I don't know. And that stuck with me. And in this regard, it's like, show me something I didn't see, if you will. So yeah, I mean, everything from watching the fans' reactions, something as little as the fans, it seemed like they're trying to will him with their chance, like as if like they got loud enough and Adam heard it, it might make that fastball go 1 mile per hour faster, something like that. And then of course, just watching Wainwright and I'm sure the guys and girls in the press box make fun of me, but I often like stand up and record the replay of a play, or even not just because it's live, but the play happens, and then like 10 seconds later on delay, it's on the screen in the press box, and I'll constantly just record it so I can have the video of the play. So if I need to go back and describe the obviously you can get any huge play on the team's website, but you can't get the 1-1 curveball to Rowdy Tellez on the website necessarily. So if it was an awesome knee buckling curveball, sometimes I'll record it. Again, 9 out of 10 of those videos aren't going to be referred to in the column, but you got the one that you do refer to.
All right, wait. So if you record a bunch of things, that's a really smart idea, actually. And you record it with your phone, and then you're writing about a specific pitch. You'll pull up that video and watch it pixel by pixel by pixel. Like, how are you?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not looking for the spin rate per se, but I'm looking for, again, like to describe the, what's the word, flow, the, you know, the curve of the curveball, if you will. Maybe the umpire does something, or maybe the catcher does something, or just simply, I don't want to just say like he pitched a good curveball. You know, I want to do a you know, pitched a curveball that made his knees buckle, some sort of description. And if I have the video, I can always go back to that. I'm just trying to enhance my sentences in any way I can with information.
Do you feel like at this point in your career, there are still original ways to describe a curveball?
That's a great question. Sure. I mean, of course, right? Give me an hour, right? I would love to come up with one, but yeah, I mean, and that's the other thing is you don't want to be too cheesy or corny with any descriptions. And that's the same with jokes in a column. Our editor, Roger Hensley, when I first started in St. Louis, you know, I'm from here. And when I started, I think I was trying to show off to everybody. And he mentioned like pick your spots on the jokes in the columns. And that really helped because let's say I was putting 5 in the column, but 2 were funny. Now I'm hopefully, if I may, putting just 2 in there, but they're both super funny. So right. Yeah, just picking your spots.
Is it okay to say a curveball buckled someone's knees?
Am I missing something? Is that
No. I'm saying like you read that a million times.
Ball
buckled his knees or the fast chin music. Are there still spots where it is okay to say a curveball buckled a guy's knees, blah, 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 froze him blank? Like, is that okay?
Yeah, I mean, on occasion, you don't want to overdo it. You don't want to be that guy. You don't want to just fall back on it. You know, you don't want to have that be your fallback all the time. I like to have fun. We all like to have fun with our writing. Something like even rhyming. I think in this piece, I did like freezes knees or something like that, where the curveball freezes your knee and then you get a little rhyme in there.
All right. So at what point in the game do you actually start writing this column?
Again, the bad and the good. I'm not writing this for tomorrow's paper because the deadline was 7 o'clock and the soccer column's in. So I'm writing this for online. So I knew I had all the time in the world, if you will, which is a rare thing. But because of that, no, I'm not like after the second inning, like, oh, and after the third inning, oh, I'm just kind of taking notes on my screen and just kind of letting it flow, knowing that I just don't feel like writing yet. I want to wait till it happens. And then write what I'm feeling.
When did you actually write it?
After we got back from interviewing Wainwright, the manager, and the players in the clubhouse.
And how long did it take Soup to Nuts to actually just write it?
Well, heck, I think I got back. I can't remember exactly, but we got back from the clubhouse, maybe like 9:30, 10. I'm trying to do the math in my head real quick. But the clubhouse, I remember this, press box closed at midnight, and I was not done at midnight. So when I got home, I finished up on my laptop. And it's not like I'm the one guy in sports writing that does this. I know a lot of sports writers do this too, but I got home and I remember finishing it 2 a.m. was something that I saw on the screen.
So again, I've never been a columnist in this modern era as far as covering events and then having to write about it. Is there no deadline whatsoever for online? Is it when you hand it in, basically?
In this scenario, like it was set to post the next morning, like 6 a.m. But yeah, in this scenario, there's no editor reading it. So, I mean, right? I think back when I started at the New Orleans Times-Picayune in 2002, you know, you'd be in the office at 4 o'clock and in comes the cavalry, you know, dozens of people coming in to work on the copy desk for that night. Now we still do have a diligent copy desk and they save my butt once a week, you know, but yeah, at when you're turning in something at 1 a.m., I guess it would always be like, you're turning something in at 1 a.m., there's no one there to read it. So you got to make sure you don't, you know, spell Wainwright wrong.
All right, let's go through this a little. All right, your lead is there are only a couple of places, perhaps a ballpark or a house of worship, and then you put in parentheses for some, those are the same place, where it can happen. One moment you're hearing something, and the next moment you're feeling what you're hearing, feeling an eye toss. That was Busch Stadium on Monday night, 8:55 p.m., as Adam Parrish Wainwright hopped out of the Cardinals dugout following his 200th win. A crescendo of cheers and shrieks hit eardrums and then jolted down arms. I've got chills still, said Wilson Contreras, Wainwright's catcher in the postgame clubhouse. Okay. Broad question. How'd you come up with the lead and what made you sort of go with that?
Well, one of my favorite things is capturing feelings. And obviously when I'm writing a column about how the front office stunk in the offseason and didn't get enough pitching, like I'm not going to describe like feelings, but when I'm doing something like this, like I want the reader to have an experience. And I'm not Jim Murray. Let's not get crazy here, but you know, I want the reader to have an experience when they're reading it, and I want them to relate to it. So how can I take the reader to the ballpark? all right, what did I just feel watching that? Gosh, when he came out of the dugout, there's chills and you can see the exuberance from the fans. You hear the sound and then you're like feeling the sound. So I'm like, write that down on your screen, Ben. And then Wilson Contreras with the perfect quote. Now, because he put the word still in there, that makes it awesome because he's saying, I've got chills still, as if like he was so moved by the moment that a half hour later, he's still feeling the moment.
So you said that was Busch Stadium on Monday night, 8:55 p.m. Why put 8:55 p.m.? Why did you consider that important?
You know, and same with putting his middle name. Like, I just feel like it's like just like a specific frozen in time history. I guess maybe the old newspaper writer in me is like, you know, this is the column of record from the Wainwright 200th win. And I always want the time to be noted and the full name.
100 years from now, when little kids are saying, what happened with Adam Wainwright's 200th win? They're going to come to this column and they're going to say, oh, it happened at 8:55.
Now, yeah, I would have thought it would have been later in the game or later in the night.
Okay, wait. So you were in the clubhouse when Contreras said, I've got chills still, right?
Yeah.
And okay, I'm fascinated by this. You're sitting there, you're in the clubhouse. Are you recording what they're saying? Are you taking notes freehand? How does that work?
I use Otter. And I remember you did didn't you do a podcast on Otter recently or about transcribing? Because transcribing is the worst thing in the world. And I always say I have to do my least favorite thing to do my favorite thing. You have to transcribe to write. But Otter, I swear, is game changer. You still have to transcribe, but you know, you just hold it there and the AI robots or whatever's in there, you know, takes the sound and puts it on your screen. So yeah, I was holding up my phone, listening to Wilson. And again, just, you know, a lot of these ball players, they say just kind of standard stuff. You're always looking for a quote that's just different, that just stands out, that can enhance your story and isn't just them basically repeating what you described in the previous paragraph.
All right, I have the nerdiest question you're ever going to get.
Okay.
Are you ready for the nerdiest question of all time?
I'm into it.
Okay. You wrote, the quote is, I've got chills still, said Wilson Contreras, Wainwright's catcher. Could you have written, I've got chills, said Wilson Contreras, still? So I've got chills, quote, said Wilson Contreras, unquote, quote, still. Let's say you liked the feel of that. You know, like, because there are two feels. I've got chills still, said Wilson Contreras. Sounds different than I've got chills, said Wilson Contreras. Still.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
Is that okay to do stuff like that? Or do you feel like that is fucking too much with the context and meaning of something being said?
Maybe in that situation it would have, but I'm thinking back to scenarios where I have done the Perlman said but I don't, when I'm constantly making, like, I'm sure you are and the listeners are too. Like, I'm constantly, when I'm writing, like, don't do anything wrong. Don't do anything that would embarrass the Missouri School of Journalism or myself or the Post-Dispatch or get me in trouble with the ethics police. So I'm constantly thinking that as I'm writing. So so when in a situation like that where you would do Perlman said I'm making sure it's not like changing how they said it, because that again would be disingenuous.
You have two paragraphs that follow, and then you have a paragraph, and your paragraph is, and it was so loud, comma, September felt like October, end of paragraph. And I wonder, like, how do you decide, again, very nerdy question, how do you decide when to go with the one sentence paragraph? What does it need to use that device?
I do it because, if I may, if the line is strong enough that it starts having you think about what I'm implying by that, I want to make it a paragraph so you have to waste an extra couple seconds to get to the next paragraph. And you're thinking about what I meant with that previous paragraph. And in this scenario, the Cardinals are crappy this year. They're not going to be in October where they normally are. But in this scenario, it was so loud, it felt like October. So that's what I was trying to go with.
It's a great line. And it was so loud, comma, September felt like October. That's really good. The comma is perfect. It was so loud, comma, September felt like October. You could have gone long dash too.
I'm a big dash user.
Another nerdy question.
Oh, I love it all.
And it was so loud, comma, September felt like October. Would it have been any different if you went either? And it was so loud, long dash, September felt like October. Or I don't know if you could do this. And it was so loud, colon, September felt like October. Like, is the comma say something different than those other two?
I think the comma just makes it kind of flow easier. There's no huge break. When there's a break, with the dash, I try to use it in my own writing. You want the reader to pause and be like, okay, what's coming next? But in this, I just wanted it to kind of flow. And that's why I went with comma and not dash.
This is, by the way, the nerdiest one I've ever done of these, but I kind of really love this stuff.
As a nerd, I'm quite honored to be part of the nerdiest one.
Right, totally. So you have the single line and then you have a quote. The crowd was unbelievable. I mean, I felt them cheering on every pitch I made, every big strikeout, said Wainwright. We had a couple of double plays there and the crowd was just going crazy. They were on their feet all night. I felt that. This is not an insult. I wouldn't say the quote is amazing. Like, it's not like a quote where you're like, holy shit, I can't believe Wainwright just said that.
Right.
Are there moments when you use a quote because it just rolls with the flow of the column, or is there a specific reason you use that quote?
I thought about that. And yeah, I like some of the stuff he said, but not all of it. But I felt like I needed to, I don't know, maybe looking back, maybe if I'd gone till 3 a.m. instead of 2 a.m., I would have been like, oh, let's edit this quote down a little bit. But I wanted Adam acknowledging it. I wanted Adam's voice saying, yeah, this crowd was amazing. This crowd, I'm standing on the mound and I'm feeling it. It's not just me and my eight teammates. It's me, my eight teammates and 30 plus thousand people screaming. And that's kind of a cool thing. And I liked, you know, I'm trying to keep the theme of feeling or felt, you know, in the column. So I liked at the end where he goes, I felt that. Like, it's kind of like a, you know, I write sometimes, I think of around the horn on ESPN and I think of the ding, you know, like, will this sentence get me a ding? And that was a scenario where like, I felt that ding.
So you're saying around the horn influences your writing in some weird way.
Here we are. Yeah.
I feel like later in my career, like within the last, whatever, 10 years, someone said to me something that kind of changed my whole perspective, which is writers should be able to say it better than the people we're covering. Cause I used to be quote, 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 like a quote machine. And I love quotes because they fill up space. Like if you have 800 words due and there's a 100 word quote, you only have 700 words due. That's lovely.
Yeah.
Do you subscribe to that? Or do you still think it is important to have the voice of the actual person in there plentifully?
I hope I'm not dodging the question, but I think it's both. I can be on both sides of it. Clearly, if you interview a guy, he's just like, it was awesome. It was great. You know, and then they start falling back on cliches and stuff. You're like, I could have said it better, clearly, in that scenario. But there's other times where it's, in my opinion, important to get the voice of the dude or the woman that was on the playing surface or in the dugout or on the bench, because their perspective and their mindset is unique from being, again, on the field. So it's picking your spots. But yeah, plenty of times, you know, how many times you hear this from sports writers, like, I interviewed him for 10 minutes and he didn't say anything. You know, he clearly said words for 10 minutes, but context wise or cool description wise, he didn't say anything. So yeah, I'm confident I can say it pretty well if need be, but I think there's an important aspect to having the ball player's voice in there, at least at times.
Do you feel like in the two decades you've done this job, you have improved at getting better quotes from athletes?
Obviously, every reporter has a different style, but we're all after the same thing. And that's the great quote, not just a quote. You know, I mean, take anybody in the clubhouse, they could conduct an interview. Any of the 33,000 people at the stadium could have walked in there with the recorder and gotten quotes from Wilson Contreras and Adam Wainwright. So it's up to us to come up with clever ways to phrase things. You know, there's so many little techniques that, you know, you try to make the person comfortable with you, maybe make a self-deprecating joke. My favorite technique is always bring up the thing they're going to use as an excuse in your question, so they then can't use it as an excuse.
Wait, what do you mean?
If Denny McClain pitched on 3 days rest and he lost, I might start the question to the manager, Skipper, I know that Denny McClain was only pitching on 3 days rest. Like I'm clearly acknowledging that. But with that in mind, if you look at his third inning, what happened from your vantage point that allowed the five runs scored? So, because then otherwise he can't be like, well, he pitched on 3 days rest. You know, he's not himself, you know.
That's a great one, actually. All right. After the quote, you wrote, Wainwright is an iconic Cardinal. But not only because of his 2006 postseason heroics, and not only because of his longevity, he even pitched at Old Bush, and not only because of his history making, be it an all-star game start or Cy Young votes earned, or now his 200 wins. He's an iconic Cardinal because he epitomizes the best of what St. Louis loves about their favorite Cardinals. He's got the humbleness of Stan Musial, the charitable heart of Albert Pujols, the mound metal of Gibson, the sense of humor of Bob Uecker, the faith of Matt Holliday, the celebrity of Ozzie Smith. Okay, I have a couple of things here. This is going to sound weird. What if Adam Wainwright is actually kind of a douchebag and we just don't know it? Like, what if he's kind of a dick and maybe he's not nice to his wife and kids? And maybe if we checked his tax returns, he made no charitable donations last year. Like, are we taking leaps of faith to a certain degree when we hail people we cover?
Great question. In this scenario, no, because he's been in St. Louis since 2005. And yes, maybe he, I mean, again, I can't talk about him behind closed doors, but from all the times I've spoken to him, all the charity events that we've covered, the people I've interviewed about him, you know, people that work with him on his charities, people who do things with his, religion. I mean, I think I got it okay with Wainwright, but to your point, I think about it all the time. I mean, think about the Baylor beat writer who was writing these glowing things about the integrity of Coach Dave Bliss. Remember that? And then Dave Bliss tried to cover up the murder of one player of another. Like, terrible, right? Like I'm not blaming the beat writer. They're doing their best work, but like, you're right. Sometimes you're not going to believe it. An athlete is an a-hole.
Somewhere out there, there are some very glowing OJ Simpson profiles from the 1970s.
Right. Wouldn't harm a fly.
Right. The big heart of OJ Simpson. Yeah. You wrote in here, okay, this is something I think about a lot. So another good one you like. Not only because of his history making, be it an All-Star Game start or Cy Young votes. And I actually wrote a Substack a while ago about how we in sports classify things as history. Yeah. I'm not being critical, I swear to God. No, it's fine. Did he really make history starting an All-Star game or getting some Cy Young votes or winning 200 games? Do we overuse history making, or am I just being an old crumpy napkin?
Well, I mean, it comes down to like, whose history? Is it St. Louis's history, or is it, I will say starting an All-Star game is pretty cool. And I think that's in your obituary, you know, the middle one there, if we're doing this, you know, I was trying to figure out like, what's another way to capture it. And he did have some amazing starts in the playoffs. I was maybe going to refer to some of those over the years, but I'm like, what's like a on the record thing that we can always refer to that is part of baseball history? And the fact that he came in second and third a few times in the Cy Young, it's like, okay, we can point to that. Now, is that, like you said, literally, is it history? And it's part of Wainwright and Cardinals and that era's history. But yeah, it's not 715 home runs history.
Well, your next line actually is fascinating. You wrote, the 6'7" starter is both down to earth and larger than life. And actually what I love about this line is it's actually two cliches that work in this rare instance. The 6'7" starter is both down to earth and larger than life. I don't know. Why'd you write it? What was the thinking?
Yeah. I mean, I try to avoid doing that as much as possible, but I've bet if you Googled me or newspaper.com to me, you could find references to human and superhuman a few times. I've done that a lot. And again, like, I mean, I'm not trying to do it about like the Cardinals backup catcher is human and superhuman. And I normally reserve it for, you know, someone like Kobe Bryant or whomever, but this was a scenario where it's like, again, I've gotten to know Wainwright through my reporting pretty well over the years. He is a very down to earth dude. And, you know, you meet 26 guys in the clubhouse every year, and every year he's the most likable and relaxed and funny guy there is. And then I see him interact with fans. All these things add up to be like, this dude is down to earth. But he's also in St. Louis Cardinals realm, larger than life. He's the guy from the picture in the 2006 World Series. He also, to bring up the Mets, who you, of course, wrote the great book about the Mets, you know, beat the Mets in 2006 with the curveball to Carlos Beltran. And he's going to wear a red jacket. He's going to be a Cardinals Hall of Famer. So he's larger than life to the St. Louis Cardinals fans. But man, he's about as down to earth as a dude can be. So there we go.
That's a really good line. Wait, I'm kind of fascinated by something. When you write about St. Louis sports, you're from St. Louis, you know the Cardinals inside and out, blah, 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 blah.
Sure.
If Adam Wainwright took a walk across America, I think he'd be recognized by 0.5% of the population.
Right.
That's no
like you play basketball.
Right. Exactly. Is that easy to forget? I'm not saying it matters even, but is that easy to forget when you're covering St. Louis sports and it's Cardinals, 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 Cardinals? Like, and does that perspective matter at all, that this doesn't really matter that much?
No, I mean, I think about perspective all the time when I'm writing something, and same thing. If you're doing something about even a lesser sport in town. I mean, I write about the St. Louis Blues, who of course won the Stanley Cup, but like, yeah, how many Blues Stanley Cup winners can you even name right now from that? You know what I mean? From that, I'm not trying to put you on the spot, but like, yeah, here in St. Louis, they're all icons, but anywhere else they're not. So I don't know. I don't have like a clear answer to your question or your point, but just kind of bringing up like, yeah, you keep in perspective that these are our guys and not America's guys.
All right. This is a funny one. Use my, for me, my least favorite word.
Okay.
If you did a search for me on newspapers.com and this word, it would just come up nonstop. You wrote, and St. Louis fans love him because of the authenticity, for how much he loves their town, loves their team, and even loves them. And then you write, heck, the biggest St. Louis Cardinals optimist in all of Cardinal County might be number 50, the St. Louis Cardinals. And heck, to me, is one of the most interesting words that we all use nonstop. Because in my life, as a human being, I've probably never used it one time. Like, right. I've been like, because I would just say hell or fuck or whatever. I'll never be sure, like, sure. That was a good game. And yet we all use it as this conversational addition. What is up with heck?
Yeah. Yeah, that, you nailed it right there. I mean, it's true. It's we can get away with it because we can't use a curse word. And it's just a way. And I do it a lot with like, I'll say, sometimes I'll say look, comma, or whatever it would be.
After all.
Right. Yeah. It's just kind of like a, like, let's look eye to eye on this next sentence. You know, I don't know. Just kind of like making it more personal. And, yeah, just, it just felt right in that moment. Cause I'm saying like thing one, thing two, thing three. And then I'm like building off it. So I was like, yeah, heck.
I think a lot of people misunderstand conversational writing. They think conversational writing is how one talks. But really, conversational writing is just supposed to sound like how someone would talk. It's not actually how you would talk. Like,
yeah,
you know what I mean? None of us would ever say heck. And I've never said after all, that movie is bad. Like, I would never say that, but I use it in writing all the time. It's sort of weird. It's hard to teach conversational writing.
Yeah. And that's why I always say, if there's any young writers listening, read. Challenge yourself to read an article about a topic that you don't even like. Why? Because you're going to soak up things and you're going to see how the writer approached their story.
Yeah. All right, you had a great line here. You wrote, and Wainwright grew too. He made his debut at 24. Flip those digits to get his current age. Was there a moment when you were writing this when you were like, holy shit, if you flip 24, it's 42? Like, how did that enter your head in some weird way?
I was writing that sentence and in my head, I was like, oh, 42 and then 24. I'm like, but I didn't know it was 24. So I went to Baseball Reference and almost like a dice roller. I'm like, you know, they're like, give me a 10, you're whatever the, if you're in Vegas and you're at a table, I was like, please have him be 24 for his debut. If it was 25, it wouldn't have worked. If it was 23, it wouldn't have worked. But because, and obviously a lot of ball players debut at 24, but I was like, yes. And then I was going to do something with like 24 and then literally the number 42. But I'm like, no, I think that, let's have the readers do it in their heads. So that's why I write, if you flip it, you get his current age, and then you have some work to do. It's minimal work, but you're doing it. And then you're like, oh, clever. I'll keep reading.
Oh, wait, I love that. It's probably my favorite line in the story because it's really smart. And also, it is the kind of thing, maybe if you were writing this in a different age where our stuff was edited more thoroughly, or you had the grumpy old editor, like when I started the Tennessean, the idea really was, don't make the reader work for anything. Make it easy on the reader. They would have put in 42 and it would have ruined the whole line.
Right.
Yeah, it's really good.
That's interesting.
All right, wait, I want to fast forward to the end. So you wrote, but to get to a level he'd never been, 200 wins, he had to go somewhere he hadn't been all year through seven innings. It just made it that much sweeter. Yes, if he had scrapped together only five innings and got the win, a version of this column would still be on your screen right now. If he'd scraped together only five innings and got the win, a version of this column would still be on your screen right now. It almost like you decided to break the wall. How come?
I don't know if you do this, but like, I'll think of what I'm trying to say. And then I'm like, all right, how can I make it pretty? But what I was trying to say was, even if he had had the crappiest win, I still would have written a Wainwright's got his 200th win column. So right. I was just kind of like, instead of trying to, I was just trying to like, I don't know, make it as honest and relatable as possible. Yeah. Even if he had had just a five inning win, you still would be reading a column about him right now. But because it was an extraordinary start, and then whatever I wrote there, I took it to the next level or whatever, however I described
it. But if it was fitting that he pitched a vintage performance to get number 200, as if it was to represent so many of the other 199. It's good, man. It's really good. And wait, and then I want to say, and when it was all over Monday, the crowd cheered the cheers and heard those cheers and then felt those cheers. Wait, all right. Again, super nerdy. And when it was all over Monday, comma, the crowd cheered the cheers, ellipses, and heard those cheers, ellipses, and then felt those cheers, ellipses. Now, there are multiple ways. Again, you could have done this. You could have gone, the crowd cheered the cheers, period, and heard those cheers, period, and then felt those cheers, period. You could have made the lines three separate paragraphs. Heard the cheers. Why'd you go with the ellipses?
I just felt right. It just felt like when you use an ellipses, again, pausing, I think that's a theme of what we're talking about in regards to using punctuation. How can you get the reader to pause just a little bit between each part of a sentence or each sentence to get them to kind of think and feel and kind of, So it was, I just wanted them to, and then of course it's a callback to the beginning of the column. And I think by making it stand out with the ellipses, the reader might be like, okay, is he doing something here? What's he up to? Oh my gosh, it's the thing from the first paragraph.
This guy's a genius.
A genius, he is Jim Murray after all.
All right, in your final two paragraphs, you wrote, there are only 33,176 in attendance, but it sure sounded like a sellout. And then it's really cool. The fans have always had his back, said Contreras, the longtime rival as a Cub, whose solo homer made for Monday's only run. Tonight they showed up and they were cheering from pitch number one. Tonight is a night to remember forever, which is a really good quote and a good end. I literally just wrote a Substack about how to end stories. Are you generally totally fine with a quote? If you get a nice nifty quote, are you like, well, that's easy, let's go with that? Or are you somewhat anti the quote ending?
I'm both. And yeah, I saw that with the kicker and you had the picture of the kicker. And it's something to think about a lot. I think about a lot when I write. And yeah, it's very easy, like you said, to end on a quote, but the quote has to be strong because otherwise you never want the column or story to end like it's a, I can't think of a better example, but like a flush of the toilet. And it's just kind of like that petering out at the end.
Yeah.
So you want to make sure, again, preaching to the choir, that you want the kicker at the end to be strong. And it makes you read those final words and either you're like, dang, that was a fun read. Or it's like, oh, I see why Benjamin wrote that there, because it captures what he just tried to say in the previous 24 and a half inches.
So when you finish the column, do you then go back and read it a bunch of times? Do you read it out loud? Do you read it in your head? Like, what do you do?
I always read it out loud. And I would say 97% of the time, I catch something.
Yep.
And so again, if there's any writers, read it out loud. Yeah, it takes 5-10 minutes, but you're going to catch something that maybe the copy desk doesn't.
What do you usually catch reading out loud? What are the kind of things you usually flag?
Maybe something as simple as like I put a Y on the word the, so it's they, or vice versa. Using Otter, right? You get the quotes from Otter, but then they're always, you know, they're jumbled and there's, and like sometimes the word Yadi, Y-A-D-I for Yadi Molina, they'll put Y-A-C-H-T-Y. Like, oh, another thing, if you're using Otter, sometimes the guy repeats himself like, yeah, it was very good. Very good start for Johnson. And then you might, the first time you might not catch the very good, very good. And it's repeated again, a small thing, but every little bit of it counts.
The number one thing I catch when I read out loud is, let's say I'll write like he was dog tired or I don't know, something. And then maybe four sentences later, I inadvertently use the word dog again. Like yeah. I also, like, oh, dog. Got to get rid of one of those. That's
totally.
It. So when you send this in, or you send most of your columns in, do you feel good about them? Are you like, yeah, I just nailed that bad boy? Or how do you feel usually?
Well, I'll put it this way. Again, I keep using like what I speak to students about. I just recently spoke to a student, so it's on the brain. Like, I want everything I write to be the best thing I ever wrote. And I know that's not necessarily realistic, but that's got to be the mindset you approach each column, because otherwise the bar is lowered. So whether I'm doing the city SC, St. Louis City SC soccer column during the day that maybe X amount of people will read, or I'm doing the Adam Wainwright 200 win column that Exponential X would read, I want both of them to be awesome, you know? So I guess what I'm trying to say is like, I don't want to write something that I'm like, oh, that was okay to your question. So Yeah, and not every column is awesome, if you will, but I want to make it as awesome as I can in the amount of time I have with the reporting I'm able to do, so I can feel confident that my name's on there and my face is on there. And a fun little anecdote is, like, you know, make your worst thing your best thing, if you will, because then your best thing is always good. When I was a columnist at Denver Post, and the job came up in St. Louis, and the editor told me, he's like, so I just typed in your name and read your most recent column. And it was about, well, now the late Demaryius Thomas. But it was something about Demaryius and training camp. And I'm sure some people have written some, like, just okay NFL training camp columns, because it's not a game. It's not, you know, a huge event. It just is what it is. Demaryius in week one of camp. But I took it seriously and wrote it really well. And sure enough, that's the one my boss, the editor, clicked on. And he's like, oh, okay. So my point is, if I had mailed that one in, he would have clicked it and be like, this guy stinks. Give me the columnist from another paper.
Before we continue with Two Writers Slinging Yang, a quick word from our sponsor.
Hey, this is Jeff Perlman. I'm here with my wife, Catherine. How's it going?
Casey's friend Anna has been here for a long time.
Ugh, I know.
She kind of smells like turpentine.
And she hears everything.
Hey, what are you guys talking about?
Oh, just RoyalRetros.com, the sponsor of my podcast.
Oh, is that the place that does throwback sports jerseys and hats and t-shirts? I love everything they make, and your podcast is dope. I listen 3 times a day. Who knew Alan Shipnuck was already working on a new book? And do you think Candace Buckner stays at the Post?
Well,
I guess she can stay.
Like you, I speak to a lot of college students. I find myself saying over and over again, like, someone will show you some of his articles. The lead will be like, the Delaware football team beat New Hampshire 35-7 on Sunday behind three. And I'm like, what are you doing? Like, right. You could write anything you want. You could take any shot. You could take any risk. You're at a college newspaper.
Right.
Don't do that. Pretend someone is reading this. Imagine someone is reading this who matters. Don't just do that. It drives me crazy. It's my number one pet peeve from college.
Yeah. I'll say, like, if I could take heroin and then write what you wrote, like, you would think that even on heroin, we could have written the Delaware football team. Like, the point is anybody could do that. And another example, I think I mentioned earlier, you could give a laptop to all 33,000 people at Busch Stadium and say, you've got 2 hours to write a column about Adam Wainwright. And I bet some of them would be pretty good, right? Yeah. So it's like, it's, again, on us, the people being paid to do it. Again, we're not curing cancer here. We're not, you know, but we're doing our job at the highest level we can. So we got to put pride in it. And yeah, like, anytime a writer settles on a lead, it really is just disheartening. Like, it's like, again, because anybody could do that. So why even being a writer? Why even being a sports journalist if you're just going to settle on the Delaware football team? And maybe they were like, I know this is at least average. And if I try something about, you know, what he had for breakfast the day before and how it, you know, and it backfires and the article stinks, then I'm worse than the Delaware football team. But you gotta, of course, keep changing. And I say it all the time. And again, I'll keep saying it to you. Like, I'm not Jim Murray. I don't want to sound like I'm like this super duper star, but the way I handle it is, like, I'll sometimes have 15, 20 of the same lead, the same first sentence on my screen, because I'm trying to nail it down to where it's as perfect as I can get it. And if you do that for every story, from the Demaryius training camp story to the soccer story to the Wainwright 200 story, you'll probably be in a good place.
And the only way you learn to do that as a younger writer is by writing shit and taking shots and trying and trying and trying. And it might suck. It probably will suck, but that's how you learn. You don't learn by writing Delaware beat New Hampshire 12-6 yesterday.
Exactly. That's a great way of putting it. Yeah. And we all have those, or maybe you don't, but we all have those columns that we, like, you think back to the lead and, like, what was I doing? But, like, I mean, I swear to God, I still think about a game story I wrote covering the Denver Nuggets against the Atlanta Hawks in, like, 2007. I still think of it to this day because I blew it and it didn't work. But at the time I was like, I think this works enough. And I went with it. But that's, you know, that's part of the job. I remember, what was it? Johnny Carson said, like, the day I'm not nervous is the day I need to retire. Like, the day I don't care is the day I need to retire.
I'm required to ask this on this podcast. What's the best confrontation you've ever had with a subject?
Well, there's been a few. J.R. Smith doesn't like me. I covered him in New Orleans. It was just coincidental. I covered the New Orleans Hornets when he was a rookie, and then he goes to the Denver Nuggets, and then I cover the Denver Nuggets. And I took a risk, talking about taking risks. I wrote a piece about what happens inside J.R. Smith's brain, like how he makes decisions. And funny enough, this was only in like 2008, I think. I mean, he had decades more of ridiculous bonehead decisions. Of course, the I'm doing the LeBron hands here, like the most famous one in the NBA Finals. But he was a fascinating guy because talent-wise, I mean, there were games he would take over and he would look like Kobe for 12 minutes. And then he would look like a matador on defense. And the thing that made me the most mad was that he, and this is sad as can be, but he killed his best friend in a driving speeding accident. And then JR would continue to get speeding tickets. The point of the story was to take the reader inside JR's brain. And I had things like, instead of the cerebellum, it was the Kobe bellum. Like that's the part where he can play like a superstar. It was a mean spirited piece, I suppose, because I was trying to capture who he was in a unique way. And you're not going to believe it, but he didn't like it.
And what'd he do?
He was just like, I'm not talking to you. I'm not talking to you. And in my head, I was like, well, he's not that good of a quote anyway. I'll go to Carmelo Anthony.
Final question. The game's afoot. You wrote a piece for the St. Louis Shakespeare Festival inspired by soccer in St. Louis. What's the story behind this?
Yeah. So follow me on this. Every year, the St. Louis Shakespeare Festival does something called Shakespeare in the Streets. They also do Shakespeare in the Park, where they do an actual Shakespeare play, and it's awesome. This is, they pick a different part of St. Louis and they have a writer write a whole play about that community. And the writer does interviews with people within the community and then writes a play, but based off a Shakespearean theme. Normally the community is the Bevo Mill community or the East St. Louis community. This year with the MLS team coming to town, they wanted it to be the soccer community. And St. Louis has a very rich soccer history. And I admit that we're a chip on our shoulder town, but really like, the history is you can't fight it. I mean, the first recorded games in America in the 1870 something. St. Louis. First leagues, St. Louis. The 1950 World Cup team that beat England in a game had five St. Louis starters on it. St. Louis has had 70 plus players play for the national team. I don't even know. I'm making this. I don't know, but maybe like the state of Texas probably hasn't had that many, you know? Right. So we have this great history. So they wanted me to pay homage to it. And I did through a play I wrote based off Henry IV and Henry V.
Did you know what you were doing?
Oh, no, not at all. The first thing was, this is kind of like a St. Louis thing because it's all about like, who from high school? Everyone's connected from high school because a lot of people don't leave St. Louis. 25 years ago in high school, I wrote a musical about baseball. And one of the students was a girl named Ellie Schwetti, who's become this like big time theater person in St. Louis. And she was at a party talking to the Shakespeare guy, Adam Flores. And he's like, yeah, we want to do this play based on soccer, but like, I don't know any like sports writer who could do like a play. What am I up to here? I'm in over my head. She's like, I know a guy, the columnist in the Post-Dispatch wrote The Franchise at Clayton High, the baseball play. You should get him. So I got this message from Adam. And so I've been making this joke that every quarter century I write a play on sports.
Also, I just want to say, I don't want to let this one go. Ellie Schwetti. Kind of an all-star name right there.
Yeah, no, I'm sure there were some things said to her that were inappropriate in the halls of Clayton High in 1997.
Let me just do a final thing real quick, actually. I had on my podcast 6-7 months ago, Rick Hummel, who has since passed.
Yeah.
And I knew, you know, the commish, and I knew him. I'm just kind of curious real quick, like, what was his impact on sort of writing and baseball and such in St. Louis?
Well, he was one of my idols growing up, you know, I mean, without being too cliched, like, you know, you have favorite players, but my idols were Bernie Miklas and Rick Hummel in the newspaper. And then later on, Brian Burwell. And I mean, these were my guys that I learned the game and I learned my two favorite things, sports and writing from them. Yeah. And Rick Hummel was just, we talk about celebrities and stars in your own world. I mean, Rick Hummel is a star here in St. Louis. You know, he's a celebrity, and you know, people will meet me and they'll be like, "So, do you know Rick Hummel, or what's Rick Hummel like?" Because he covered the Cardinals at a high level for decades, yeah. And he influenced all of us even to the last year. And some of my favorite memories are, and I know Ben Fredrickson, our other columnist, has said the same thing, where some of the best memories are spring training, when you're driving from some Florida town to another Florida town, you're in the car with Rick for an hour and you're learning about reporting and you're hearing stories. And he influenced me greatly. And I'm sure everybody on our staff would say the same thing.
Guy was a great guy.
Yeah.
All right, man. Well, listen, thank you so much for doing this. Thanks for taking the time. Thanks for having the patience. I just want to say, heck, it was a great episode.
After all, it's fun to do.
Thank you so much for doing this. I really appreciate it. I want to thank today's guest, Benjamin Hockman, for joining me on Two Writers Sing and Yang. You can follow Benjamin on Twitter at Hockman and read his work in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. If you have a chance and enjoy Two Writers Sing and Yang, please go to the vehicle of your choice and leave a nice review. I'd be really grateful. Music is by the sizzling MC White Owl. Thanks again for joining me, and remember, keep writing.